oral history documentary screenings of Priced Out and Lost City, Living Memories, and tours of the historic Vanport City. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event from May 23rd to May 28th, taking place in various venues in North and Northeast Portland. More information about the festival, including specific performances, screenings, dates, times, and venues, can be found at kvoo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. My guests today are members of Oregon Voices, a group that, as stated on its website, advocates for rational sex offender policies. And I'm here with board members Bob Brown and Ken Nolley.
Hi, this is Bob.
I'm Ken.
Welcome. And let's make it clear from the outset, Oregon Voices in no way condones sexual exploitation or violence. According to your website, though, you are working to replace the current fear-based approach to sex offenses with an evidence-based system that truly serves the public interest. And you also want former offenders to understand that they did not give up their right to human dignity and the right to pursue productive goals in life. And so could you say that that's basically what you guys are about?
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah,
it sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Okay, and so just to get started then... Also, the website states, we are fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles and grandparents, members of families that contain victims of sexual abuse, as well as those who have committed sexual offenses. And so I'm assuming that applies to each of you, and I'm hoping that you could just start by talking about why each of you became a member of Oregon Voices. Would you like to start, Ken?
Well, we got involved in Oregon Voices when a family member was arrested. We didn't know quite what to do. It was probably the darkest moment in our lives, and we started looking for other people who might be in that situation who could, who would understand it. And one of the things we found were two or three other people who were thinking about starting an organization, and we became a part of that. And so in 2009, the fall of 2009, the organization was founded, and we really started as a group. At the beginning, we were mainly a kind of family support group, holding each other's hands, helping each other to understand what we saw that we didn't think was what our country stood for. And subsequently, in a year or so, we decided that we really needed to become involved in legislation, and so we started attending legislative hearings and listening, and were really involved in the legislative process for the first time in 2011.
Wow. So you were basically, Ken, you were one of the founders of Oregon Voices.
We were there when it was founded.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how about you, Bob?
So I'm thankful for Ken for founding the organization. I also have a family member who is, who's incarcerated right now for something that he did that he shouldn't have done. And Ken spoke about, the darkest hour. Well, it was a darkest long time for me. I had nowhere to go. I was looking for some kind of support system. It's not something you can just speak to anybody about. I found Oregon Voices, and I started going to meetings, and it was a place that I felt that I could be genuine and could tell people what was going on with me. My son is currently incarcerated. There aren't too many people. It's a few people, but there aren't too many people who participate with Oregon Voices whose family members are incarcerated right now.
But there's a fair number, I guess, who end up in jail and then get out, but they're on parole for a very long time, and then, of course, on sex offender registries and
right.
that kind of
right.
thing.
Right.
And I might add to this, too, that the mutual support that families provided for each other, we began to realize fairly quickly, was a really important part of a community responsibility, because we thought if our loved one, if our family member was going to make it when they got out with all the problems they would face, they needed support. And when we looked around, we found everyone who worked with people in this area said, families just drop away. They aren't there. And that means that huge numbers of people in the registry don't have support. And we believe that we want those people coming out to have support. They're much less likely to reoffend if they've got some sort of support in the community and a way back into a productive life.
Right. Well, as it, you know, it says reintegration and rehabilitation are a huge part of what you guys are in favor of with all this. And what we get really from reading about it is more like these people are the lowest of the low. They deserve nothing. I mean, there's a whole contingent out there kind of speaking that way about
yes.
these people.
Yes.
Yeah. And so right now, I think I read on your site there's 750,000 people throughout the nation who are labeled as sex offenders, 30,000 here in Oregon. And actually, listening to a talk, a woman was talking about how now there are 800,000. Now there's 815,000. It just, these numbers are growing.
When we started Oregon Voices, I think the size of the Oregon Registry was about 16 or 17,000.
16 or 17.
And so
it's doubled.
In less than a decade, it's virtually doubled.
Because, I mean, once you're on, it's very difficult to get off.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there's no relief valve.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about, like, who are these sex offenders, starting with some of the ones that seem like there should be some way for them to get off. For instance, I was reading about some of the more lower settings for a sex offender. Maybe a teenager might sext a girlfriend, and that's considered these Romeo and Juliet sort of things. Could you talk about some of that? Like, who gets on this that are maybe that really should be reconsidered?
So, you know, these are stories. I don't have any firsthand information, but I've heard a lot of these stories, and I don't, you know, I expect them to be accurate. I mean, it could be an offense of a 10-year-old exploring, you know, with another girl. And
Playing doctor.
Yeah. It could be something like that. A 10-year-old, right? And, you know, somebody complains, and they get arrested, and you know they're put on the registry for life, you know, from 10 years old on. Usually I'm assuming they don't serve a lot that, you know, time, but you know they do get put on the registry. So there's, you know, and it could be as simple as somebody, you know, touching somebody maybe inappropriately or maybe by accident would get on the registry. It could be somebody, you know, I mean, the, you know, that you know, a homeless person who's peeing in the bushes. You know, that could get somebody on the registry.
So that would be an indecency.
Public indecency.
Right.
Public
yeah.
indecency
right.
gets you.
Right.
Yeah. And I read about, for instance, someone who is a husband and wife in a park can be arrested for public indecency if, you know, they said the park was empty, we were in our car. But
this happened in Salem several years ago. So a couple were feeling romantic and remembering their earlier times and were parked in a empty parking lot at Bush Park. And the man went on the registry after that.
The husband's on the registry for life.
But not the woman?
Not the woman.
Or for decades, anyway.
Yeah.
Not the woman. Interesting.
Yeah.
And then, the 9 or 10-year-olds, that's amazing. Like, I read a New Yorker article about a girl who was she 11 or something? And she just was trying to pretend she was following a movie on television. Her parents weren't home. She was playing with her 9-year-old stepbrother. And then she became a registered sex offender and had to go to all that. This was in another state. So one thing we should get to is how different states have different laws. And as you were saying, the feds have different laws,
yeah.
too.
But still, these problems are pretty widespread across the country there. The details differ a little bit, but...
Right. And one last one that's kind of, that I thought was for young people, or not young people, people that maybe we should reconsider it. Autistic, mentally repaired, brain damaged people sometimes get caught up not really knowing what's going on when they're looking at computers in the privacy of their home, and they might accidentally or they might deliberately download pornography. Maybe that's not such a good thing, but if it contains children in it, they are surveilled and they are eventually busted and can be thrown in jail. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's pretty common. And I mean, Bob mentioned, you know, we hear story after story after story doing this work, and you never know that all the stories are perfectly true the way they've been told. But when you hear patterns of stories over and over again, you begin to believe these are there. But there are, it seems to be that internet crimes are particularly epidemic among socially awkward young men who've never had a relationship with a girl, never really had a girlfriend, and so they turn to the internet for that sort of thing. We think it's not appropriate that they go to underage porn, but when you look at the lives these young men have, and they're often not much more than, they may be very close to being juveniles themselves, you can understand how it happens. There are stings where chat rooms are set up, and police are monitoring that, and there's a policeman that the person is talking to, and they don't know, a policeman or a policewoman. And they may say that they're a girl who's 18, but the policewoman will say, but that wasn't really, it wasn't a real person, but they're responding to something they think is legal. We have a couple of cases in our invoices where this has happened, and they're prosecuted anyway, even if they believed and had reason to believe that the person was of age. So
in other words, they think they're interacting with an 18-year-old. It's actually a 16-year-old.
It's actually maybe a policeman who says, I was pretending to be a 16-year-old, but didn't say that I was a 16-year-old.
Right. And they can still be prosecuted for that.
We know of cases where it's happened.
Wow. So. Yeah. And I have a friend whose son, he's actually had some concussions and traumatic brain injury, pretty isolated, and... Mm-hmm. That's basically why I'm actually doing this show, because it just seemed pretty, like he thought that he didn't realize. He just didn't realize. And I think one of the biggest things that we need to get out there is that this can happen, that it's not publicized enough. It's like you see big billboards against mothers against drunk driving. There needs to be big billboards, maybe. Watch out what you do on the internet.
Yeah.
It could get you really in a lot of trouble.
I think with the kind of people that you kind of mentioned, I think they're mitigating factors. It's not okay to do those things, but they are mitigating factors that should be taken into account. A lot of times people just need to be told. This isn't okay.
Yeah.
And we're never told.
Yeah, exactly. Like my friend feels that if someone had just told her son, don't do this again, he wouldn't have done it again.
Right.
He never would have done it again.
And we, over and over again, we hear that story that people just didn't know. And it's not just this. Juveniles do dumb things. They do things that we don't want them to do sometimes. So it works in that case too. We really strongly believe we need better, much more widespread education, both for parents and families and for kids, about what the laws really are.
Yeah, so this is how people kind of get trapped, right? And once they're trapped, it's a whole nother story.
Yeah,
right?
Which we also need to talk about. Right. So I want to let listeners know you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm with Ken Nolley and Bob Brown. They're both members of Oregon Voices here on the Recovery Zone to discuss their working to bring rationality to our sex offender laws. And you can call in if you'd like with questions. Here, the phone number is 503-231-8187. So let's get to some of the laws. I just talking to you before the show, I learned that there's Oregon laws, there's laws for every state, there's all kinds of different laws, it turns out, for like what the age of consent is in different states, and there's also federal laws. And I learned that this whole thing got started in the 90s, the sex offender registries, which I really want us to get into talking about what they are and what and how they work, with the passage of two laws, Megan's Law and the Jacob Wetterding Law. And then I guess there was another law that came 10 years later, the Adam Walsh Child
Act,
Protection.
Yeah.
So could you give us some background here and why these laws were created and what they were supposed to accomplish?
Well, in many ways, all of these are a kind of perfect example of what we do when we have a big public issue. In each case, there was a pretty sensational crime that was committed. And in each case, Congress went to enact a crime to try to stop those things from happening, named it after the victim. But in doing it, they were driven by indignation and fear of about what had happened. No one was looking at what the evidence is about who commits new crimes. And the whole notion of setting up a registry, that the end of it, end product of it all, was the Adam Walsh Act and the setting up of the Fed's attempt to set up a federal registry of sex offenders, because the thinking was, if we could know where all those people are, that then we could stop sex crimes. There's a New York study that showed that, looked at who commits new sex crimes, and it revealed that between 95 and 96% of all new sex crimes are committed by somebody who's not on the registry. And that suggests that if we could be 100% effective with the registry, we might reduce sex crimes by 4 or 5%, but that's virtually where we put all of our efforts.
Is into the registry, but maybe some people think, well, because they're on the registry, they're not committing crimes. Do you run into that argument?
No, people think that they may be able to stop them through the registry, but there aren't very many crimes being committed by this group, for one thing. And the other thing is that in the studies that have been done, and there have been a number of studies that looked at this, the registry doesn't do anything to reduce the incidence of sex crimes. In other words, when people are on the registry and not, you know, in different circumstances, there's no difference.
So, I think I did a little reading before this meeting, so the number that I came up with that I read in a study was that 80% of victims know the person that has offended, against them, and those people are not on the registry. So 80% of victims. So
it's just like some family member or a neighbor
or a friend.
Religious leader.
Right. It's not somebody on a registry. Like, I actually looked up the registry for my zip code. I found two people. One lives under the Burnside Bridge. That's his address.
Right.
And then the other one was on another street many, many blocks away. But the point being that I don't know. I'm not going to be worried about... somebody that's on the registry, we're supposed to be hiding from them. Is this what the registry is supposed to be doing?
What's the registry supposed to be doing? I don't know what the registry is supposed to be doing, except, outing people inappropriately for something that would inhibit their ability to be functioning members of our society.
Uh-huh.
That's what the registry does. Yeah. I'm sure that the original thinking was, well, if we just let people know, then, these sex offenders, then we'll be safe. But we know that that's not true.
Right. I mean, well, and you're saying that what were your numbers again?
80%.
80% are not on the list.
Right, our family members known to the victim.
Yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah.
They might be on the list, but usually they're not.
Right.
Virtually always, though, they're not. And they're just someone who's in that person's orbit already. They know them, their family knows them. That's the normal thing.
Uh-huh.
That's where the most sex crimes are going to come from.
And so... So before all these laws were passed in the 90s, were there sex offender registries then, or were they, this just all started?
I don't know the answer to that.
There weren't.
It was a new idea.
So this just all got started. Yeah. It was a new idea. Let's do sex offender registries. Somebody thought up this idea. And
So I guess it's just interesting for me to always ask or point out that there are no registries for burglars. There are no registries for murderers. There are no registries for anything else, right? So, what's the deal,
Well, obviously, America's love-hate relationship with sex.
Right, exactly.
Something like that, Maybe the Puritan background that we all, anyway. So, you guys really, I guess, are questioning, what I got on your website, the justice of this registry. Is that what I'm hearing then?
Yes.
Well, I think it's the justice of the registry and all the other things that are associated with the restrictions on people who have been convicted of sex offenses in their life.
Right, right, right.
The registry certainly is a big deal.
Right. Yeah. But back to the registry itself, it seems to me that there's some constitutional issues with that, and I want to get to what goes on with sex offenders when they get out of jail, mm-hmm. for sure.
Okay.
But just the constitutional issues of the justice with the registry, could you address that a little bit?
Well, the registry leads, the argument that's been made and that the government has made in establishing the registry is it's just a regulation. It's like having to get a driver's license or something like that. But the registry is far more than that, because it's not simply going to sign up and pay a fee. The secondary consequences are enormous, and so when people come out of prison in Marion County, where I do reentry work, for example, they face a very tough housing market as they do in Portland, and there is just no housing available for people coming out with sex offenses. So it's no surprise that some people are living under bridges, but you have to question: are we making a safer society by that? And is it just to create pariahs like this who have no way to come back into the society? When we allow any other crime to begin to make a new life.
Yeah, second chances, in other words.
Yeah.
And how long are people on this registry? Like Oregon has a three-tier system. Other states have other systems.
Well, the three-tier system is new and isn't functioning yet, but it will begin to function next year. Up until now, the only way to get off in Oregon was to go to court. And given the fact that most people on the registry have very little money and often don't have jobs, that's not an option open to them. And so it was very rare for people to get off the registry. For most people, to register in Oregon was a lifetime thing. So the new system will provide a way off. Other states have different approaches. Some states have lifetime registration. Florida does, for example. But others have routes for people to get off after 5 years or 10 years if they have not committed another crime. So it's a checkerboard across the country.
And in Oregon, because it seems that my friend's son was at 5 years, he can. I mean, he's a low risk person.
Yeah, well, that's the way the new system is set up, so that the new system will be based. Well, we often say it's a risk-based system. It's not entirely that. It's
ten years.
It's a modified risk-based system. But what the new system does is use an actuarial tool for adult males. It's a tool called the Static 99R. For women or juveniles, it's another instrument called the LSCMI, and it will establish a risk score for each individual, and they will be placed then in one of three categories: low risk, which is level one; moderate risk, which is two; and high risk, which is three. And that will start taking place. That will actually happen beginning in January 1st of 2019.
Mm-hmm. And so, if you're low risk, you're on it for like 10 years or something. Or
if you're low risk, you can apply to get off the registry after five years after you're off supervision.
Uh-huh.
So if the person you're talking about is on supervision for 5 years, then there'd be 5 year more wait after that before they could apply.
Wow. Okay.
And then they apply. I mean, it's not a given.
Right. Right. So you apply, and then there's for a second level, it's 10 years.
It's 10 years after you're off supervision. You can apply to go to level one, and then you have another 5 years and you can apply to get off. Level three can apply to get down to level two, but they cannot go below that, and they will never be able to get off the registry.
And you can end up getting listed higher on the registry if, for instance, you fail to register. I mean, you're on parole here for a while when you do get out of jail, and if you don't register within 10 days or something, if you've moved, I mean, there's a lot of little mistakes that people make where they find themselves getting higher risk ratings.
I don't think that that's true. I think you know, if you violate your parole, then you've reoffended and you could get sent back to jail.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the deal about, you know, not doing what you're supposed to be doing. I don't think it impacts.
The risk instruments aren't built around that thing specifically.
Okay.
Although if someone were actually charged with more than a violation, you know, there are questions of whether it's a violation. They might go back to jail for a while with a violation. That's probably not going to affect it. But if it's charged as a crime, that will affect their risk score.
So the thing of it is once you're on this registry, as you were saying, you have a harder time finding a job. You have there's other issues that people who are labeled as sex offenders are dealing with, and I'd like to get to some of that. For instance, on your website, it talks about how the registry contributes toward joblessness, which you mentioned, homelessness, which it's harder to find housing. There's even deals with threats, harassment, vigilantism, towards not even the sex offenders themselves, but towards their families. Children can be harassed at schools, that kind of thing. And maybe we could start talking first, like exclusion zones. What are those and what are the ramifications?
Well, most states have some kind of residency restriction. A fairly standard thing is either 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet from a school or a park or a place where children gather. Oregon, thankfully, doesn't have that. In 2011, there was a bill proposed to establish 1,000-foot residency restrictions. That was when we first got our feet wet in the legislature. Oregon Voices was there, and a lot of other people who were upset about it, too, that we didn't know, many of whom did join OV afterwards, came and spoke, and the bill died in committee, did not pass. And we're grateful for that because it means that make finding housing is a little bit easier. We did a look at what does that mean? What does it mean if you establish a 1,000-foot restriction around each school? And it was a bit of a research project, but we concentrated on two areas. We concentrated on Salem, which I knew, and on Northeast Portland. And when you draw 1,000-foot circles around all those prohibited places, and there were very few places. There were a few more places in Salem, especially along the freeway corridor. But Northeast Portland was virtually
blacked out. Schools everywhere.
So what it means is there's no place for these people to go. And that doesn't mean they're not in the society. If you're afraid of them, wouldn't you want them to be stable and their life to be stable? Because all the research suggests that people's lives are stable are less likely to reoffend.
Right. I want to let listeners know again, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. I'm speaking with Ken Anolly and Bob Brown of Oregon Voices. This is an organization that advocates for evidence-based and rational treatment of sex offenders. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment yourself, the phone number here at KBOO is 503-231-8187. And so your website's talking about the Oregon Voices website, just questioning the utility of to what extent then is, we talked about that, the sexual registry, a deterrent to repeat offenses. But when you talk about people are on this list or they've gotten out of jail, they're a sex offender, what is life like for someone like that? What happens then? You're out of jail.
When you're out of jail?
Yeah. Where do you go? What do you do?
Well,
And you said that right off, a lot of these people, their families have just
right.
dropped.
Right. So, I mean, it's housing is almost, is very, very difficult. You know, we're getting calls at Oregon Voices about housing. Where can I find housing in Grants Pass, for example, right? Housing is very difficult. Work. Just like any felon, right?
Right.
It's worse for sex offenders, much, much worse, because people don't even look beyond, well, they're a sex offender, therefore they're not on the list. You know, they're put on the side.
And they don't look at, like, maybe why they're a sex offender. It's just that
right.
the label sex
it's
offender.
It's a blanket label.
Right.
In Marion County, where where I work, we get requests for, can you help us find housing? There is a reentry center in Marion County called the Demunis Reentry Center, which is named after former Chief Justice Demunis, whose idea it was. And they maintain a list of housing possibilities for people. And when you go down that list, you see time, place after place after place that says no sex offenders. It's just a blanket thing. Don't even go there.
I think one thing that I hope that people listening will understand is that the general feeling is, and the general thinking is that, you know, if you're a sex offender, that means you're a certain kind of person. You're a predatory person hanging out by schools, trying to do bad things. And so that's the thinking that are perpetuated in our society, which is not true. There's all kinds of different people there are those people, there's not very many of them, but there's lots of people who don't fit that, and they're all labeled the same.
Yeah.
They're all labeled exactly the same. There's no distinction.
Well,
at
it's
all.
Just what we were talking about, the mm-hmm. couple having intercourse in their car in an empty park.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Or something.
Right, right, right.
He's a sex offender now.
Or the 17-year-old, hooking up with an 18-year-old.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be that, because you have to have it has to be 3 years, but it's
okay,
with
right.
it's sex between, you know, some young people where the age is just
a
little bit enough.
Year old, yeah. Maybe, or something yeah. like that. Yeah.
And it doesn't even have to be sex. It could be the thinking about sex.
Right.
You know. But
we have a caller, by the way. What would you, Crystal, would you like to make your comment or say what you'd like to say?
Hi there. Yes, thank you. I'm in Oregon, and I know two people that were convicted in other states where I think it's stricter. One is a friend and one is a family member. And it's really devastating in so many ways. So my firsthand experience with that is how they suffer from not getting jobs or housing, and then in prison being especially poorly treated. I mean, because they're like considered the worst of the worst on every level.
Worst of the worst,
Yeah, and then what they told me was so disturbs me. I don't know how to get out there and stop it if it's true. But they said, so in the one case, it was like they were on this forum and they were interested, you know, it was back in the days when people that were gay couldn't really communicate very well. And they were on a forum and they said, hey, let's meet up. And then at the last minute, this person mentioned something to the effect of, well, I'm younger than 18. And so he was curious to see, like, if that's true, like, who is this bozo? And they're like, okay, you know what, let's just meet up, you know, just like, out of curiosity, like, who would do this? And maybe, I don't know. It's just that I know these people so well, I can see kind of somehow the logic. Like, if I was going to meet that person and say, hey, you know what, you shouldn't be going on forums and telling people that kind of thing. Anywho, so he got caught because it was a sting.
So just meeting somebody was offense.
Yeah. So just to even, like, see what this person was all about, like, what the heck is wrong with you, buddy? But whatever. So it was a sting, and they immediately just assumed that was a crime. Now, when, you know, our mayor, you know, meets a guy that's less than 18 in the public restrooms of the city hall and knows it, like, he doesn't get caught. I don't get it. At any rate, so the other issue was that it wasn't a forum, it was videos and just downloading video, like you were saying, some people do, they just like to download things. And some of them were child pornography, and God, it's kind of good to talk about this stuff because it's so hard. No, there's no way to talk about it anywhere. But anywho.
Join Oregon Voices.
yeah, so they said that it wasn't a forum, that these websites are put up by the government, that they're actually put out there, and if you click on them, there's no warning that comes up and says, hey, you shouldn't be here. So the government isn't going through these things and finding them and putting up warnings to people. They're actually producing them.
Could I break in here a little just to respond to that? I don't know that that's true, but what I am told by people who are actually in the system is that that law enforcement does find these websites. They don't close them down,
right.
They monitor them. And pick up people visiting them.
So they would rather you know, arrest people than to remove the threat.
Right. So, and if it's really a problem, maybe the people who are running these websites and the people who are creating this kind of videos or photos
are one and the same.
They should be the ones being looked after and busted.
This is a complicated thing, though, the websites where they're chat rooms and so on are one thing, and then the sharing of underage porn is another thing.
Well, there was no sharing going on is the thing they were saying. It was because that this, not just that this person was going through it, but was downloading it.
Yeah, but the way that these things are done is through file sharing programs. You don't go to a website.
Well, yeah. Okay.
And the way it works is your computer has to develop the software, has to have the software installed in order that to be downloaded. And what that does is allow someone else to download that stuff, and they may get it from your computer then. You may not have even known about it, but the general thing that happens is people are at least threatened with charges for distribution, even though they had no notion that they were distributing anything. Usually that, I'd have to say, to be fair, they're usually not charged with distribution, but the threat is big enough to get automatic guilty pleas and
through plea.
Right, from the people at the bottom of the chain. Yep. So my question again is, like, if they know where these sites are and who's distributing them, those are producing them, are disseminating them, then those are the ones they should go after. And I don't think anybody was protected in this whole, you know, in the end it was just this one person gets to be scapegoated and treated horribly for the rest of, you know, his life. And meanwhile, no child was helped. No person who's producing it has been caught.
Right.
And the authorities are involved.
And it's a non-contact thing on the part of your friend.
So I just want to say something about underage porn and people doing things. I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about the injustice from that is potential. But I just wanted to say that, you know, this is not a victimless
very,
crime.
Yeah.
Right.
Truly.
I mean, there are victims here.
Right.
And,
the kids.
You know, and these kids. Right.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, I think we just need to remember that.
And we need to go after the people doing it.
Right.
As far as I can see.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not okay.
It's not okay at all. Yeah. And it shouldn't be encouraged or paid for or anything like that, as far as I'm concerned.
I think we all, in Oregon Voices, we think that underage porn is appropriate that we sanction it.
Uh-huh.
But we would like to see some kind of recognition of the difference between someone who is perhaps socially awkward doing a bad thing and the people who actually made it, who did a really bad thing.
Okay, Greg, Crystal, we're going to move on to Greg, but thank you very much for your comments. Greg, are you there?
Yes, hi, how are you doing?
Hi, yeah. What would you like to say or add?
I would just like to say I'm a convicted sex offender. I was convicted when I was 18, where the crimes were when I was 16 and 17, but the conviction landed where I went to court right when I was 18. So under Measure 11, everything was tried as an adult.
Yep.
When I was first convicted, I couldn't go home because I had an underage sister where they just automatically make it so you can't be around minors. But at that age, all my friends, you know, half of them are at least minors. And so I had to go stay at a homeless shelter for about 4 months, you know, until I could find appropriate housing. You know, fast forward from that time, I mean, that's just going to be terrible anyway at that age. But luckily enough, you know, I've got a decent job now and I've got married. I have a family, but a couple young kids, but just it scares me to think about, you know, that there is no means of reprieve from it, where as technology is getting easily, you know, and readily available, you know, eventually when my kids are older, they could just look up any name and find out, you know, about what my status is. I won't be able to go to school functions, you know, for my kids who might be in a choir or something like that, you know, later on down the road without being afraid of, you know, somebody recognizing me or so, or realizing that I'm on the registry because I can't go onto school properties. And I just hope that something can come down the line, you know, for people who are, because, you know, that changed their lives around for sure, because this was a good 15 years ago now, and I don't know what I can do to get off a registry. There's nothing out there or available to me, but the general mentality of everybody who I've talked to, even friends that I have, a lot of them don't know about my conviction, and it's hard to talk about, you know, because the first thing I think is you've done some really, I mean, disgusting crime, you know, maybe even a child molester or something like that, where they all have the mentality is they all need to be shot. You know, there's no rehabilitation for them. And even in counseling, too, I had to go through counseling after I got convicted, and the counselors, the first thing they tell you, there's a guide, you know, or spreadsheet that they go off of to say, statistically, based on your crime, you will reoffend, you know, in the next 2 years or 3 years. Pretty much they say that everybody in our room was going to reoffend within the next few years, and there's no hope for us.
That's encouraging.
Yeah. I have several responses. One is that the recidivism data is most definitely not that, and what you were told is not true. There is also, we're trying to work to make information available to people like you who don't know how the new system will work. And so if you get a hold of Oregon Voices, we'll try to share with you what we know about the new system to take a little of the mystery about what's going to happen out of that.
So can Greg get off or get unregistered?
I don't know enough about his case yet to be able to say that, but we have things that could, we have a flowchart that can show pretty much probably what to expect.
And there are people that can get off.
Yeah. There are people who can get off. And
right, which is new, which has not been the case before.
But we still worry about, and I think Greg will have the same, you know, was worrying the same way, is what difference will it make when I'm off the registry, because people will still be able to find out that I had a sex offense.
And, right.
So
any background check would.
The registry is a problem, but a more widespread problem is people's sense that all sex offenders are dangerous and likely to reoffend, which is, nothing could be further from the truth than that. Sex offenders have the lowest recidivism rate of any particular category of crime.
Really?
And it's just not true that there are high recidivism rates out there. So
that's, it's just a myth. It's one of those myths.
Yep.
You know,
yeah.
And it's been perpetuated by our Supreme Court.
Yes.
Well, by our Supreme Court has perpetuated it. Somebody said something in the Supreme Court. What was it, Justice?
It was Justice Kennedy. He was referring to an article in Psychology Today that was many years ago. It was actually written by a treatment provider in the Oregon system who was saying that he thought that perhaps 80% of the people he was working with would reoffend if they
80%.
Didn't have treatment. He didn't have any data for that. He just pulled that number out of the air. And Justice Kennedy, in his decision, called the recidivism rate, the danger posed by these people, as frightening and high. And that language has persisted in legal opinions
down
to this day.
Right.
Yeah,
that's the highest court in the land, and everything flows down from there. So you know, it was a big problem. And even the person who wrote the article said, "Well, I don't know where I came up with that number." Right?
Yes.
I mean, you know,
really,
yeah.
Yeah, and so yeah, so they're operating, our whole legal system, you're saying, is operating off totally non-evidence-based.
Yes, off a myth.
A myth, yeah. And the other thing I think that Greg brought up is that it's not even just, as you said, the registry. It's the fact that you can do background checks on people. The internet itself, you know, you might get off the registry, but are you going to get off the internet with the fact that you were a sex offender?
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, there's, you know, there's news stories that stay around forever, right?
News stories and the actual sites that
right.
Try to publicize, you know, you have sex offenders in your neighborhood.
That's right, that's right.
And can those be, like,
well, there is just a decision that came down. It was one of the websites called mugshots.com is being prosecuted. They're being prosecuted for extortion, because they are really extortion rackets. And
if you pay us money, we'll get you off the registry.
Yeah.
Oh, off our website.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So we'll put you on there with this label, and you know, if you want to get off, pay us money.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it sounds like extortion to me.
Yep. Yeah. So there's a lot of that, and just listening to like Greg's stories and Crystal's about her friends. I mean, it's a very, very difficult situation. Again, as you were both saying, that people find themselves in once they've been put through this whole thing.
Yeah, I just want to congratulate Greg for
yes.
for getting from where he was to where he is right
yes.
now.
Right.
It's just really,
good work, too, Greg. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, with all the handicaps that people have, it's not easy to do.
Right. Which goes to even like the psychological effects of this on the people who are living with it. It sounds like, I mean, there's higher levels of depression and suicide, for instance. Are things like that happening?
Yeah, there have been studies, and there's a lot of ancillary effects that come from this, and they don't just affect the person on the registry; they affect the family of the person on the registry.
You guys.
Yeah. So imagine, a father gets convicted for a sex offense, and he gets out of jail and he can't go to home because he has an underage child in his home. He can't live with his family anymore. So, I mean, that's just one example of, and imagine what that would do to somebody coming out of jail if he's been in jail for so many, for a little bit of time, maybe 5 years, and he gets out and he can't go back to his family.
Right, right. And so he can't get a job again. He can't support his family. He can't.
So the psychological effects are, for many people, are devastating.
Yeah. Social, psychological, economic, they're all there.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And it's just, as you say, it doesn't even happen to murderers and stuff. okay. Hang on, we're going to just say Bob Brown and Ken Noly of Oregon Voices. It's an organization that advocates for evidence-based and rational treatment of sex offenders. And this is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. We have 15 more minutes to go here, and you can call in if you'd like with your questions or comments. 503-231-8187. And we have another caller, Dan. Would you like to say or add anything to the conversation here?
Yeah, hi folks. Good morning. I appreciate the points you're making, and certainly am very much a fan of KBOO in general. But a small complaint, if I might, you do a disservice to your listeners, I think, when the gentleman called in and spoke of his experience, it might have been good to ask him a bit about what the specifics of his case were. And indeed, one of the commentators said, well, gee, I don't know what his case was. He had a real story to tell, but he gave one side of the equation, but not the other. Just a caveat to you folks as interviewers. Small complaint.
So let me respond to that. I think people do things when they're young or when they're inexperienced or when they make mistakes that aren't good. No matter what no matter what we say, they're not good. However, does that really matter when you're thinking about a person where he is right now, right? So. This is the whole notion of, once a sex offender, always a sex offender. Well, that's not really true.
That's not remotely the point I'm making. And I accept what you're saying mm-hmm. as valid. I'm just making a point that, information wasn't there. Not to castigate the person mm-hmm. or condemn him and not to fail to recognize the journey he's made towards wholeness, but do your job as interviewers.
Okay, Dan.
I
take that you wanted to know more about Greg's story. Yeah, and I think as Bob is saying here, possibly he didn't want to share it. And
well, he couldn't if you didn't ask.
That's true. And I should have asked. And thank you, Dan. Just to get back to this again, what's going on? And definitely, this is an emotional issue. I like the whole thing, as we said earlier, no second chances, and that kind of thing. What sorts of efforts are going on, at least here in Oregon, toward rehabilitation and reintegration? You guys are trying to work on stuff, or is anything actually going on in the state to help people get back on their feet again?
Not much.
Who are convicted of sex offenses?
Yeah.
Not much for sex offenders per se, but I would say that there is a big change that is taking place, and sex offenders are benefiting it in some ways. But the last couple of legislative sessions have shown the legislature wanting to move much more toward alternatives to incarceration and to thinking about ways to reintegrate people back into the community faster and more safely. And so when people are coming out of prison now, I'm seeing much more support in the community corrections, at least in the area I work in. When we first started doing this work and we asked people about their relationship with their PO, they always felt that the parole officer, we kept hearing over and over, it's just gotcha. They're just trying to catch me and make me, and they're not supportive. I think it's for quite a while now, at least in Marion County, when I ask people about their relationship with the PO, I hear over and over again, the PO is great. They're trying. They know what I need to do to succeed. They're working to help me succeed, and they're trying to support me to get there. And that, I think, is a big change, and it's part of this larger movement in the state to try to stop seeing prison and punitive measures as the only thing that matters here. Almost everybody who goes into prison will come out again, and they will come back into our communities, and we want them to be able to come back as productive,
successful
right. citizens.
Except for everybody's going to come back, except for a bill that just got passed where second offense people, in some cases, are going to prison for life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Oregon.
In Oregon.
Yeah, it reflects the sense that some people have that that people who have failed twice are going to be always dangerous, and they've done so much bad stuff that they should be locked up forever. There are really two things at play here. One is the sense of whether these people will reoffend or not, and the other thing that's at play is whether the whole notion of life sentences, and all of us don't necessarily agree about that either, but there are really two issues there, I think, with that. I disagree with it on both counts, but...
Me too.
Yeah.
I can just say a little bit more about why that is.
Uh-huh.
People change over time, and, my family member who's in prison right now, he's a very different person than he was 5 years ago. And, he's going to be in prison for a long time, and there's no reason for that. He's a very different person, and he has no chance of anything, any possibility of getting out more appropriately timed.
Right, right.
There's a group in Canada, a research group that has looked at recidivism over time. And they came out with a major study just last year, and it suggests that in a certain period of time, everybody who comes out after a sex offense their risk of recidivism will drop continually over time. Doesn't matter whether they were high risk or low risk, it will
sex go drive down. Drops yeah. over time.
Well, it's partly well. It's partly that. But that some people coming out 5 years after they're out, they're indistinguishable from anybody else who's had any kind of felony. Uh-huh. And we don't have those people on the registry because they have a felony. And at that point, this population is indistinguishable from that population. After 20 years, they discovered that no one who had been 20 years offense-free in the community, even the people who were the highest risk at the beginning, those people are getting to be indistinguishable from somebody who had any other kind of felony.
So this is basically why Oregon Voices is pushing for evidence-based.
Exactly.
Yeah. We did have another caller.
Yes.
Great. Okay, tell us your name, caller. Hello?
Hello,
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your name? We lost your name in all this.
Susanna.
Hi, Susanna. What would you like to add or say?
Well, I wanted to say I've known two convicted sex offenders, one totally appropriately charged. He was, 40 years old and had a relationship with a 14-year-old, was convicted, did his jail time, got out, worked hard to do all he had to do, which if he saw me, he had to write down constantly what he was doing to submit to the parole officer, and he had a male parole officer that okayed his hiking, that worked with him and made it possible. And then he left, and a new parole officer who, if what my friend said was true, as a childhood survivor myself of sexual abuse, I thought she may have the signs of having it herself and was very zealous. So finally, he couldn't go into the small town at all, so shopping was difficult because she found he was a sign painter, and she found a photograph of a famous Astoria sign that he may have painted and that had a teenage girl walking down the street when he took the photograph.
So in other words, this is a parole officer that...
Anyway, he ended up committing suicide because he could not do anything anymore.
That's a terrible story.
Yeah.
And a parole officer who was less than...
It is a terrible story, and I wish it were the only time we'd heard a similar one. But yes, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, we have another caller, but we really only have like 1 or 2 minutes left. So would you just ask Mike? Mike, go quick. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah, so much recovery brings people together on the victim side and otherwise, especially some victims that have some understanding of this stuff. And Vietnam vets go to back to Vietnam, that sort of thing, a lot of healing. So what does your organization do in the future about that? Thank you.
Well, we see ourselves as committed to a restorative justice model, and particularly with sex crimes, as Bob has already mentioned, that in 80% of the cases, the victim knows that person who has abused them, and often it's a closer relationship with that, and we feel like both, you know, the victim has been hurt, but the perpetrator needs to deal with the hurt, needs to recognize that, to take responsibility for that, but they're a part of the same community, and if in some ways there's a reconciliation, a recognition of the need to heal on the one hand and the need to correct and change and rebuild a life on the other, you can build a better society than if you try simply to continue to punish people forever.
That's good. And so basically then, like, you know, your website, and maybe you guys would have a few last comments for people and how to get involved.
Well, we're a small organization. There are 30,000 people on the registry. That's about 2% of the adult males in Oregon are on the registry. And we are only a very small number. And if people are alone out there and feel like you don't have anyone to talk to or don't have a source of information, that's what we're here for. We advocate for practices that will make more sense. We provide support to each other. And we have information that can help people navigate the changes that are coming. So get in touch with us. We are... could always use more members and more people to provide that mutual support.
Yeah, our website is OregonVoices.org. Is that correct?
I think so. It's
OregonVoices.org, right. And any last comments from you, Bob?
I just appreciate the opportunity to tell a large group of people how I feel about the injustices that are going on. It's also interesting to me that all of our callers had people that they knew who were sex offenders and what that did to them, and they had firsthand knowledge.
Right.
So, you know, I think we need to be hopeful that things will change. At least I'm trying to be hopeful that things will change over time, and that, you know, that we will, you know, we'll have different perspectives over time.
Yes. I'd just like to thank you both for being on the show. I've been talking with Ken Nolley and Bob Brown. They're board members at Oregon Voices, and their organization consists of those labeled as sex offenders and their friends and families to create a more rational and evidence-based approach for promoting public safety, rehabilitation, and successful reentry into the community. I'm Stephanie Potter. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. Thanks to Tammy Dean for engineering, and thank you for listening. Thank you.
it's noon. It's time for Jazz Libs.